This is the Sophia Mare Studios podcast. Hi, I'm Amy.
And I'm Jess, and we're the Rambling Raven Puffs.
Because Potterheads are far too nuanced to be shoved into just one Hogwarts house.
Each week, we will cover two chapters in the saga of our favorite boy wizard.
All the while exploring literary themes, tarot card exercises, and even fanfic speculations.
To connect with us, your fabulous host, and other listeners, join the Discord server for Sophomere Studios.
And to support the podcast and gain access to exclusive bonus features, consider joining our Patreon page at patreon.com/sophiamarestudios, all lowercase.
Thank you for tuning in, grab your butterbeer, and enjoy the show.
Welcome again to the Rambling Raven Puffs. Welcome to the show, everyone. I'm Amy.
And I'm Jess.
And today we are covering Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows, chapters 25 and 26, Shell Cottage and Gringotts. And we have a special guest with us today. Returning to us is my one and only big sister, Holly. Hi, Holly.
Hello. Hi.
Yes. Did you guest on Half-Blood Prince, or did you skip that book because you were busy?
I think I skipped it because it went by so quickly. I'm surprised how quickly all of this has gone by. So yeah, I didn't pick one in time. And even this one, I think you were like halfway through it by the time I was like, oh, if I want to do it, I have to actually.
I think we were a third into it, but you are not the only ones, because Amanda and Kevin also skipped Half-Blood Prince because they had things going on. But you are here, and thank you for being with us. I actually just saw you last Wednesday because when I upload these, it'll be the normal weekly basis, but it's actually been a good 2 months since Jess and I recorded because I got sick, she got sick, you had something that came up,
life
Holly.
So,
like, just everything all at once.
Everyone was busy. Yeah.
Yeah, everyone was on
this is a retrograde.
Yeah, Mercury retrograde, worst Mercury retrograde of my life.
Really was.
It really was. For everybody.
Mm-hmm.
So it was literally got like a month of just things, the stars not aligning, and then another 3 weeks where I took off for vacation. So,
we
are back and we are reemerging. Yeah. And so, yeah, finally, as Jess put it, the two chapters that would not be recorded are finally being recorded.
Yes. Yeah. It sure felt that way. Go ahead. Sorry.
No, just Jess, I know it's probably been a little bit, but overall impressions of these two chapters, coming back to it after a while.
I am going to ask Holly for her impressions of these two chapters because I have had every intention of getting further through these than I did. So Holly, guest, I'm going to pepper my thoughts in, but I cannot heavy lift on this, and I sincerely apologize. Things have just been a little crazy. So,
I mean, in terms of what I thought, again, I've read the book before. I've read Harry Potter several times, so, I remember everything that happens. Actually, what I did was, it's kind of funny considering what I rushed to do and then we didn't record for like many, many weeks. But I didn't have time to reread the whole book. Usually when I do one of these, I'll read the whole book up until the chapter just so that I've read them so many times. But because of that, I don't always know like what's been covered so far in the book. And I don't want to say anything that's actually like happened, that happens in like the later chapters. I don't want to spoil anything. So I'll reread. I didn't have time to reread this one, so like the weekend before we were supposed to record, I did like a power read. I like skimmed the entire book and took notes for all the plot. It took about 3 hours total, but I like went through the whole book like just skimming it basically until I got to these two chapters. And then Yeah, I mean, when I was picking them, I was kind of torn between these two and like the two previous chapters. I think there was a thing happening where I was picking chapters where Dobby was often
featured.
Like one of the featured characters, which is funny because he's not like my favorite character. Like, I mean, I like Dobby, but you know, it's not like my all time favorite. So yeah, I don't know. For these chapters, I just kind of liked the contrast of what I like about this set of chapters is you've got one chapter that's kind of more of a little bit more low key, like, what are we doing? Have we made the right decisions? You know, I think there's a little bit of like more like, why hasn't Dumbledore explained this better? Like, were we supposed to get the Elder Wand, or did we make the right choice? You know, whatever. There's like a little bit of that. And then of course, like planning and talking to Griphook, which I guess I picked it maybe partially because of Griphook. So instead of talking about Dobby, it's like some interesting things maybe we could talk about in terms of like goblin culture as opposed to house elf culture. But and then the next chapter is very like action packed, right? You know, like kind of tense, like breaking in. And yeah, I don't know. I just thought it would be like an interesting set of chapters. So, I mean, my impressions are kind of just, yeah, I think there's a lot to sort of ruminate about in the first one in terms of like, once again, does the team know what they're doing? Did they really get enough guidance the way they, you know, that they probably should have from Dumbledore? No, before his death, probably not.
Yeah.
And then like the second half is again after like the fiasco of breaking in at the ministry. It's like it kind of feels like they're going into this, they're breaking in somewhere else again, and maybe didn't plan it quite as well as they could have planned it. I don't know. That's my impression.
Yeah, so it's interesting me coming back to these chapters because I've made it no secret that traditionally Deathly Hallows has been my least favorite book, not even of the series. Yeah, not even necessarily because it's dark or anything. It just did not, you know, go in a direction I envisioned. And honestly, when it came out, I was like, I read fanfic versions of book 7 that were better than this.
Really?
Yeah.
I liked that it deviated. Was it because of the school? Because they were like not at the school.
I think that's a big chunk of it. Deviating away from the school model, which again makes sense, but also, you know, I think I've explained in other, even probably our last episode we recorded with the Wandmaker. I felt like, again, Harry as the writer does so much foreshadowing and peppering things in the earlier books that when I first read Deathly Hallows, I did not like how all the wand lore stuff was shoved in at the end. And I'm just like, this could have been sold to me much more if this had been more peppered in throughout the series. Because again, with all the other stuff that's foreshadowed and peppered in, Harry the writer makes the standard very high. So I think that's another thing. Yeah. But anyway, so there have been rereadings of the series for me where I have literally skipped over chunks of Deathly Hallows, because again, it's not my favorite. And I think the parts that I did skip over a lot were like Malfoy Manor and Gringotts, just the action, like the more action-packed stuff, because I tend to be more interested in the drama aspects. But
what about we're not talking about that chapter in this book, but like the Godric's Hollow chapter, like I really liked that chapter. I think I kind of liked the fact that they were going to other places and trying to we're outside of Hogwarts. Now what do we do? Like there's just a whole, it's like a bigger sandbox of things to do and like potential leads to follow, I guess, which is both frustrating but like kind of interesting.
I like that part. I think it's also possibly that the Golden Trio is so insulated from everyone else throughout the book. But anyway, so you know, revisiting this chapter, it's probably been a really, even though I've reread the series so many times, it's probably been a super long time since I really like dug into
read the actual chapters.
Read at least the actual chapter of Gringotts. It's actually probably been quite a while. and you know, and I find, and again, you know, being a dividing it up into the chunks the way we do, you know, just two chapters for a week, I, you know, again, I felt I appreciated it. I was listening to the audiobook and, you know, we got like, there's only 5 minutes left of the chapter and they're still in Gringotts, you know, in the middle of things. And I'm like, oh, is like the escape, am I forgetting something? Is the escape on the dragon, like, is that cut up into like another chapter and we have a cliffhanger? But like, no, in that 4 minutes of audiobook left, they get on the dragon and escape.
Wow. Keeping it tense till the end.
Yeah. But anyway, let us begin first with chapter 25, Shell Cottage, which as Holly, both ages, easy mistake. As Holly pointed out, the beginning of chapter 25 is peppered with a lot of indecision and sense of doubt in terms of, because the previous chapter, they make the conscious decision not to go after the Elder Wand, which they had realized was in Dumbledore's tomb, and Harry has his vision that Voldemort now, you know, broke into Dumbledore's tomb and got the wand. And it's just an interesting, the fact that these chapters took so long, like, you know, for us to finally sit down and record, because it's the end of the Deathly Hallows movie, part one, is when Voldemort gets the wand. So it's just interesting that we've had this period of so long not recording, because that is the exact, you know, cutoff point between parts one and two of the Harry Potter Deathly Hallows movies.
We should just say we did that intentionally to match up with the movies. We're like, oh yeah, everything kind of went to hell in April and May, and but you know, that isn't what happened. We did that intentionally.
Yeah. So
yeah. I'm not as familiar with the movies because I honestly, I didn't even see like the Deathly Hallows Part 1 and 2 for a really long time, just because I'm not as into the movies as I am the books, and I think eventually I watched it. Yeah. Once, and yeah.
Well, Holly, Jess's like 10-year-old niece is critical of those movies.
Critical?
Yes. Yes. She is now very into anime. So I've lost her on Harry Potter, but she's very into anime. Anyway, yeah. So, but
yeah, particularly she was disparaging the Goblet of Fire movie.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, books are just so good, in my opinion, that it's hard to make something on screen that captures everything.
Yeah. So Ron is expressing more kind of discontent about the decision, because I think when Xenophilius first talked about the Deathly Hallows, like each of the Golden Trio represents has a different priority and different worldview. So for Ron, the Elder Ron is the absolute best of the Hallows, where for Hermione, it's the invisibility cloak, and for Harry, it's the resurrection stone. So Ron is still really put out that they didn't go for the Elder Wand. And all this sort of weaving in of Dumbledore leaving clues about the Hallows, yada, 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 it's got Ron thinking, is Dumbledore actually dead? Jess, what did you think of this line of theory?
I think there are a lot of like, what do you call it when somebody dies? There's like the five stages of grief. Is that right?
Oh, denial.
Yeah. I feel like that. I mean, I feel like Dumbledore, as much as, you know, I'm a Dumbledore fangirl, I think he's pretty dead.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's a goner. Now the only thing that I can't quite figure out in this series if he is going to be like accessible through, you know, some other means, but we haven't been able to contact Sirius Black, so I don't know. So I think he's done.
Okay.
I think he's dead.
Yeah. And then what do we got? Because there is the mystery around how did Dobby know to come for them, and who could have possibly sent Dobby? Because because Harry saw that blue eye in the jagged piece of the mirror, and that's really tripping him up. Oh, I know you had your theory, Jess, of the guardian angel, quote unquote.
Yes, I feel like I might have. Yeah, I think I know who it is, but and it's not Dumbledore, unfortunately. It's somebody who. I don't love in particular.
Yep. So we've got, and then Grip, we've got Grip Hook. So I guess in the, you know, if I'm remembering correctly, you know, they proposed to Grip Hook in last chapters that, okay, we need your help getting Great Gods. And he's like, I'll think about it. And so now he's finally ready to come back and talk to them again. And there, his whole deal is, you know, despite it goes against every ethical code of Gringotts, of the goblins, I will help you break in on the condition that you give me the Sword of Gryffindor. Whoa. And they're just like, we need it.
Right. Because if I'm recalling, the Sword of Gryffindor could break the Horcruxes, right?
Yeah, because it has Basilisk Venom, it's the only thing they have in their possession at the moment that could, you know, destroy a Horcrux. So, and there are more Horcruxes, so they're not in a position to immediately destroy the one in Gringotts they're looking for. And then, okay, we did it, here you go. Like, they still need it for the others, unless they can find, you know, some other means.
Yeah.
So, yeah, as Holly also is pointing out, again, the insights into, you know, goblin culture, and then we get further insights from the input from Bill near the end of the chapter. And Jess, you and I have talked a lot about, you know, I feel like I've honed in more so in this rereading than other rereadings about the potential problematic allusions to the Jews with the goblins.
Yes. Yeah.
So Holly, I know you first, you know, talked about, again, insights into goblin culture. So again, tell me more about, you know, getting the whole interaction with Grip Hook and the gang and bargaining for the Griffith Sword of Gryffindor.
Yeah, so this is interesting just because I'd heard some other stuff about this recently, which was kind of odd timing. But like Grip Hook and the goblins, obviously, you know, there's this whole thing, you know, and again, in terms of wizards maybe subjugating them a little bit, like they're not allowed to have wands, you know, they don't have the same rights as wizards, although goblins do seem to have a lot of power because they run the bank. It's unclear if it's like the World Bank or just like the British Wizard Bank. But yeah, so there, I brought this up with my husband. I'm curious what you guys think about it. So I don't know how I heard this, because when I first read and watched like Harry Potter, I didn't think this about the goblins at all. It didn't cross my mind. But there's a lot of people out there who think they're like, you know, a negative stereotype of like Jewish people, like Jewish culture, right? And, you know, it's kind of weird. I mean, I guess it's because of, you know, you think of like positions held like in like earlier centuries, you know, as creditors and lenders, which was acceptable position for maybe Jewish, you know, communities to have, but they weren't, you know, fully accepted into society, you know, that kind of thing. And again, it's so timely that we're doing this chapter, because my husband watches like John Stewart, like The Problem, or listens to The Problem with John Stewart, because he's a John Stewart fan. And I think like John Stewart even like brought up this concept at some point, like at how they're like a very derogatory stereotype, the goblins. So I didn't think this at all when I watched it. If anything, they make me think of the dwarves, like from Tolkien, because like they're metalsmiths and all, and like that kind of thing. But so here's the thing. So my husband is Jewish, and I asked him, like, oh, like, do you think this is an obvious stereotype? And he was kind of offended that people think that the goblins are a Jewish stereotype.
Oh, wow.
So it's like, I don't know what to think about this. Like, is it like a thing we should be cognizant of? I think there's like other weird things that happened. I was reading about this. So in the first movie, the set of Gringotts, there's like a six-pointed star on the floor, like the Star of David. So like there's these weird things that kind of make it worse, I guess, in the films. I mean, I don't know what else people, I think people have like said something about like large noses, like they're an untrustworthy branch, you know, stigmatized as an untrustworthy, like stingy branch of society. So anyway, I don't know if I'm naive in not having thought of that before, but my husband, who is Jewish, thinks it's offensive to think that they are a Jewish stereotype. So I don't know. What do you guys think?
Well, I am like you, Holly, where I did not pick this up on my own in any rereadings, that only through Harry Potter nerddom of diving in to literary analysis for fun did I come across this possible allusion. And I think I first came across it because my last rereading was about looking more into like the pagan actual, like the roots of like Wiccan magical practices in the real world and how they manifest themselves in Harry Potter. And I think from there, I kind of realized possibly that, you know, a lot of stereotypes about witches, overlap with a lot of stereotypes about Jews, like with their, like the hag and the big nose and like all of those things. So I think, yeah, so I didn't get exposed to it till much, much later. And so I didn't go too much into the possible Jewish thing, but I have here in my notes goblins as imperfect victim because, you know, they're certainly a marginalized group, but their situation does not mirror the situation of house elves, who are clearly very, very overtly subjugated. It's not even the same as the centaurs, who probably have the same level of contempt, you know, as goblins do. But at least the centaurs like live in isolation. They're not trying to like integrate themselves and hold leverage through this one element of society, like banking, the way that the goblins, you know, use that to hold leverage in a society where they are, you know, they're not the prominent, you know, the dominant species. So yeah, I was just thinking about that is, you know, people like Ron. Well, Ron is problematic in a lot of ways.
Ron is always a hopeless case.
Hopeless in regards to house elves, but he's even worse in regards to goblins and his approach towards Griphook because as I mentioned in my notes, like goblins, you know, fight back and, you know, willing to protect themselves and, you know, hold themselves on their own, and that automatically that gives them less sympathy because they're not the perfect helpless, helpless victim. And honestly, it kind of made me think of you know, obviously there's all the, you know, tensions about, again, people with, you know, crazy protesters with guns showing up at like drag story hours. And so in response to that, like Antifa and other people and full out other members of the LGBT, you know, gay, you know, community have shown up, you know, with their own guns in Texas to protect certain events. And even in the news piece that was like covering this whole thing, you know, there was a lot of debate about, you know, amongst the LGBT community, like, is it good or bad if we, again, if we meet these protesters with, you know, with our own guns, because we automatically lose the sympathy card because we dared to arm ourselves and protect ourselves.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, yeah, the goblins, yeah, I mean, as they're doing the bargaining, well, I guess later as they're doing the planning, there's a comment about how Griphook seems to be kind of like not a great like person, you know, kind of relishing in the idea of like the violence towards wizards that might ensue or whatever. And like, yeah, like I was reading about this too. I think, I mean, maybe we can talk more in the bank chapter, but it's been implied that goblins don't like sunlight very much, you know, like Griphook's in like a room where he keeps like the shades closed and stuff, and the guards outside the bank are actually wizards. The, you know, goblins don't stand outside the bank. So, and then obviously Bill Weasley is employed by Gringotts. So, you know, goblins employ humans, and I even read somewhere that humans are employed for like as like dragon feeders, which is a very dangerous job. And you know, they've got, you know, again, you've got goblins maybe like treating animals like dragons poorly because they're being chained up and like, you know, tortured and tormented, and you know, and like humans, I guess, lose their lives like just being the caretakers of these dragons, but the goblins make humans do it so that they don't have to. So you know, it's like both sides have their, you know, shortcomings. And I think what I take away from like the bargaining piece with Griphook specifically is just, I don't know, if people were just more forthcoming in general. What I don't like about it is I especially don't like the part when, you know, they kind of obviously they're kind of surprised that he'll help them in return for the sword, because that's like a huge problem for them. So when they discuss it, and then Harry's like, well, we'll promise to give it back, but we just won't say when we'll give it back, right? And then there's like a line that's like, Ron thought this was a brilliant idea or genius idea. And it's like, well, that's a warning sign right there.
Right. Poor Ron. I mean,
Ron, Ron thinks something's an excellent idea. I don't know. Maybe you should be concerned, but... Yeah, I don't know. This is sort of getting into my what if question, but like, I don't know why they just didn't tell more thoroughly their situation. Like, we need the sword, we'll give it back to you, but we need it to do these things, and we'll either have to give it back to you at a later date, or like, you can take it, but we're gonna have to come to you, and you're gonna have to let us use it, like, when we need to use it. You know, or something like that. I don't know. That would have... Because Griphook, like, we find out, or it's kind of clear, like, doesn't trust the pact that they've made.
Is there any sort of, like, question as to where the goblins' loyalty lies? I mean, I don't... Or is there any sort of allegiance with... Or are they just kind of like their own thing, like with Voldemort?
I think they're neutral, right?
They're kind of neutral-ish, or at least started neutral-ish, and but, you know, because again, just wizards being in power, that's not a substantial, at least at first they thought that's not a huge substantial difference, but the fact that Griphook's helping them, you know, Griphook and other goblins are realizing that, oh, you know, things weren't, you know, great, but with this crazy guy, it's even worse.
Yeah. Okay. Interesting.
Yeah, it's not shown in the book or anything like that, but I think in the movie, which I barely remember, I think Voldemort goes on like after the vault has been robbed. I think Griphook.
Yeah, he goes on a whole killing spree.
Yeah, which doesn't happen in the book, but yeah, I think it's implied that they're not a fan of Voldemort's regime necessarily, but obviously not a fan of the current, you know, system either, you know.
I just didn't know if that might be the hesitation to tell, like, what they're doing with the sword. It's just because, I mean, I know it's an item that's very important, but if there was sort of any question of allegiance, then they would be like, no, I don't want to tell you.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah, and even though it's not directly brought up in the negotiation with Griphook, but I'll bring it up now because Bill, later at the end of the chapter, you know, says, you know, clearly you're working with Griphook. I need to warn you that their notions of ownership and payment aren't the same as ours. They clear, like, if someone commissions a piece of, you know, something to be made, goblin made, they consider that purchase price as merely renting. And so if when the original purchaser of that goblin made item dies, goblin culture dictates that that item should be returned to its maker. And so there's this whole dispute about, you know, the story of Gryffindor was stolen, because in the wizarding perception is, okay, Godric Gryffindor commissioned this sword, he paid for it fair and square, and it was his, and he passed it on to his descendants, blah blah blah. Whereas the goblin version is like just that whole notion of, you know, passing on goblin made items, you know, in a form of inheritance, is, you know, as Bill says, to them is little more, is basically the same as theft.
Yeah, what I kind of wonder about all of this in general, in terms of like world building, is why isn't this something that has been addressed yet? Like, I get that in the past, you know, relics were made, paid for, and then handed down by wizards, and goblin culture was like, whoa, like, that's not how we roll, like, that's not okay. But like, this is the modern era. You know, it's, I assume, an era of bureaucracy and contracts and legal agreements, et cetera, et cetera. Like, how come there haven't been, I guess because all these relics are so old, so it's like, who really does own them? But like, I don't know. I would think in the modern era, at least for newer objects, like, you know, you have a contract written up that's like, okay, wizard pays for it and keeps it, or it's in the contract, wizard pays for it and gives it back. You know, like, there'd be some established system by now, I would think, to like be an agreement, or at least even on a case by case basis, there would just be some system, I guess, is what I'm saying, for how like paying things for things that goblins have made. Like, how that would work. And then for things like the ancient relics, like, you'd think there'd be a court case or something, even if it wasn't resolved, like, maybe just a long drawn out, like, oh, it's the great, whatever, Gryffindor sword court case, like, they're still working on it, or whatever. But it just kind of seems like the way Bill's talking about it, it's like, yeah, this is a problem, like, wizards think one thing, goblins think another, and just, like, it's a problem forever.
And yeah, let's see. I don't know. One possible answer to that would be that, again, goblins hold leverage via the banking system, but they're still, again, a marginalized group. So maybe through a variety of means, whether it's like if they were to try to insist upon their own values of ownership and stuff, that none of the wizards would buy anything if they had to keep repurchasing and repurposing it. So I don't know. Maybe, you know, maybe they're conceding, not because they want to, but they're conceding certain, certain, you know, practices for the sake of, you know, staying in business with wizards for economic viability. I don't know.
Yeah, I suppose. I mean, yeah, it's hard to really know without knowing more about the universe, I guess. But just, these are just the things I'm thinking. Like, why aren't there more solidified agreements? Why are some of these older relics not having, you know, haven't been decided upon yet? I mean, we know that like certain ones have been lost, like the locket and the cup or whatever, like no one knows where they are.
Yeah.
I mean, except Voldemort. But like the sword is like, and you know, at the school, like it's a publicly identified like relic. So it's like, does the school own it? Do the goblins own it? You know? Yeah.
Well, according to Rufus Scrimgeour, the school owns it because he wouldn't give it to Harry.
Right.
So, anyway, so, you know, through all of that, they go with the plan of, we'll promise to give it back, we just won't say when. And again, Ron thinks this is a great idea. And Hermione is just like, is not on board with it. But finally, that's what they decide to do. And clearly, Griphook doesn't seem to be convinced at all of their sincerity, because Griphook starts pulling a Molly Weasley and literally won't let the trio be by themselves for fear that, you know, give them a chance to talk and conspire.
Oh, man.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can bring this up later, but it is interesting that, again, it seems like they didn't plan for, like, sudden eventualities, you know, possibilities during the actual break-in, such as all the security measures have been triggered, you know.
Right.
Oops, we didn't think that was going to happen. And so, like, Griphook didn't tell them about, you know, we'll get to, there's, like, the waterfall that removes enchantments and, like, the duplication thing and the, you know, like, all these measures that can potentially happen. Apparently, Griphook did not share any of this with them. So,
like, at least not until it's, like, started happening.
Well, right, right. But I mean, like, again, in terms of planning for a mm-hmm. break-in to, like, the most secure place, supposedly, in the yeah. wizarding world, Griphook didn't really give them a lot of information, it seems like. So he either did that on purpose because he was, you know,
yeah,
not expecting,
he's,
yeah.
Yeah, probably thinking, like, you know, these little snot-nosed brats, I'll get them. Well, in the movie, he directly says, I said I'd get you in, I didn't say I'd get you out.
Dark.
Yeah, so yeah, because he was probably, again, just stringing them along until, because he knew he could get out by himself because he's a goblin, he knows yeah. how it all works, but he did not do that with them. So yeah, so ultimately that's what that less than ideal plan bargain is, what is decided. And
then there's like this brief moment with the Tiat, like, Ollivander's leaving, Fleur asks him to take, like, the tiara she'd borrowed back, and Griphook is, like, eyeing the tiara.
Yeah, and it's, like, made by goblins, and Bill's like, and paid for by wizards.
Again, Bill works in this field and kind of presents himself as... Sorry, can you still hear me?
Yep.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, I got a thing that said disconnected, reconnected. Bill works in this field, and he's over here kind of like, I'm the expert on, like, how these types of relations work. And it's like, but are you, though? Like, it seems like there's no established system for how these relations are supposed to work, kind of. It's just both sides kind of being butthurt at each other.
With, yeah. Like the real world.
Like, yeah, so in that, you know what? In that sense, maybe it's very realistic.
Yeah.
So, yep. So Ollivander and Luna, I think, go on to Auntie Muriel's house, and we get a surprise visit from Remus Lupin, of all people.
Dun, 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 Remus Lupin.
Yep. And Remus has come in to announce the birth of his son, Teddy.
Yeah, this is a nice reprieve from all the...
All the heavy...
Griphook. And society and etc.
Yes, nice reprieve. And I love just everyone saying congratulations, and I love that Ron's like, blimey, a baby, as though he had never heard of such a thing.
Mm-hmm. Oh my yep. goodness.
And it's very sweet that Lupin asks Harry to be the godfather.
Aw, it's very sweet.
Yeah, I've always been kind of sad that Harry is, I mean, you know, obviously Sirius was killed, and that's, you know, not great, but like there's so much emphasis from Harry a lot of the time in the books on you know, his dad is gone and now Sirius is gone too, but like Lupin is also there,
mm-hmm.
you know, to support yeah. him and stuff.
Yep, so Harry gets named godfather, everything is happy, and then after that, it's when, again, what we already discussed, that Bill is trying to give Harry the lowdown of, this is how goblins think, you need to be careful, blah, 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 and this just fills Harry with a bunch. He already wasn't feeling great about the, you know, about the bargain in the first place, and what Bill, the insights Bill gives, just makes him feel even worse.
Yeah, and then, like, look at what Bill and the goblins are out here doing together. Breaking into crypts in Egypt and stealing, I don't know, probably Egyptian stuff and bringing it back to England. So it's just
pretty
layers. Yeah, it's just layers and layers of just everybody, like, probably not being, you know, of taking things and there being no system or agreement upon how things yeah. are paid for or taken or who owns what, and et cetera. Yeah.
Well, again, reminds me of our only vacation before the one we just took, my husband and I, is we went for like a little weekend in for a few days in Chicago, and we went to the University of Chicago's, like, you know, museum for, like, Middle Eastern stuff, and their collection is very well known and very extensive, to the point that I think they've had a lot of court cases about, like, various Arab, you know, Islamic countries being like, this is ours, like, it was taken under colonialism or whatever, and we want it back.
Yeah, but I guess that's the perfect example. Like, you've got two sides saying they own something. No one wants to come to an agreement. So I guess, you know, possession is 9/10 of the law or whatever that saying is. So
yep. And the chapter ends with, I love this, he seems set on a course to become just as reckless a godfather to Teddy Lupin as Sirius Black had been to him.
Ooh. Dang.
At least he's aware.
Yeah, I guess. Yep. Chapter 26 now, which is Gringotts, the heist. I guess Ministry of Magic was also a heist chapter, but this is the ultimate heist chapter. So they spend weeks trying to prepare for the heist in Gringotts. And as you said, Holly, clearly there's a
weeks of preparation.
Yeah, like, this isn't days, this is weeks, and there's a clearly, comparatively, we found out later, there's a shit ton that Griphook did not disclose to them. So how is he BSing them through all these weeks?
It's like, well, Creature was not a goblin, right? Creature is a
house elf.
But he was pretty what is lying by omission or something.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I think it'd be interesting, because for all the planning that they're supposedly doing, and as complicated a building as Gringotts is, with, like, multiple tunnels and all this stuff, like, it doesn't seem like in a pinch that they utilize any, you know, like, I think it would have been more cool for it to have been like, oh, like, this thing is happening, like, we have to move to plan C or something, you know, and it's kind of just them flying by the seat of their pants, like, we're Imperio, you know, Imperio this one dude and just keep plowing forward. And again, there was no mention of some of the security stuff apparently throughout all the training, or maybe there was. I read it in the moment as if they, as if the trio, you know, were surprised at what was happening, like they didn't know what was happening.
Yep. And so Hermione was able, from Malfoy Manor, to get a little bit of Bellatrix's hair. So they decide, and they've got a tiny bit of Polyjuice potion left, so they're going to have her impersonate Bellatrix, because they also have Bellatrix's wand.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Yeah, and Hermione is complaining about, you know, I hate using this thing, it feels so wrong and icky, and Harry has to restrain himself from, like, saying I told you so, because she was so very much like, oh, you're not trying hard enough, with, like, his, like, replacement wand.
Yeah
the wand that killed Sirius, that's what this wand is.
The wand that killed Sirius is the wand that tortured Neville's parents. All sorts of diabolical.
Yeah, so. I didn't necessarily think this was a bad plan. I mean, in retrospect, I think it becomes clear that the bank's been informed that maybe there'd be an impersonator, you know, because the wand was taken, you know, and all that stuff. But, like, in the moment, this part of the plan I didn't think was that bad. Like, I thought this was a pretty...
Yeah. Well, again, the only thing they could have done is, you know, for the bystanders, like, having her be Bellatrix is very good, but they should have had, like, code green if they realize that people know something about Bellatrix being imprisoned, or, like, again, that someone's been informed of something, and just, you know, okay, we'll do this if we run into those people.
Yeah
But again, they're all 17. They don't know shit from Shinola.
Shit from Shinola, I've never heard that before.
Oh, you haven't? Oh, my dad uses that one a lot.
That's funny.
Yeah.
So Hermione's Bellatrix. Ron is who? Someone else.
Some random guy, because they literally only have enough Polyjuice for Hermione to be Bellatrix, and
Harry's under the cloak. Is that right?
Yeah, and Harry's under the cloak with Griphook.
Okay. I mean, again, another thing is they could have stalled and, like, Harry could have gone by himself. Well, I guess they need someone to escort them, but
mm-hmm.
just thinking out loud.
Yeah. Again, there is, Holly, there is a, I know you're not as big into fan fiction as I am, but there is a very popular fan fiction where through a variety of happenstance and different decisions made that Draco Malfoy gets dragged along with the Golden Trio in their Horcrux hunting.
Okay.
And the way they get into Gringotts and all of that, how that plays out is very interesting.
Sounds like a very elaborate fan fiction.
That, well, it's a novel. It's a whole, like, rewriting of book 7.
Entire rewriting of books. I was going to say, like, is it from the point of Malfoy Manor on, or it's just...
No, this is, I think it's from where Draco decides to take Dumbledore's help at the end of book 6.
Oh. So does Dumbledore die?
He does, but in a okay. slightly different, in a slightly different way.
Okay. I am very curious now, but yeah, I usually don't read a lot of fans.
Yeah, so anyway, so interesting. I'd be curious to go back to that one, just poking all the holes in this shitty Gringotts plan, if all of those are addressed or not addressed in the other really popular version of this.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so yeah, so they leave at the crack of dawn. They specifically tell people, like, not to, like, you know, see them off, or, like, because they don't want to have to explain why the hell does Hermione look like Bellatrix.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so they leave, and Ron is just like, we'll just have to wing it, mate.
My gosh. No, yeah. What was the weeks of planning for?
Yeah, let's just blow that up. That feels like sometimes that's how I, like, approach work some days. I'm like, eh, let's just wing it and see what happens, which is never a good thing to do. But yeah.
I'm approaching that in my life. I used to be a much more meticulous and counting minutes type of person, and now it's just like, eh, I got this thing done I was supposed to, and tomorrow I'll just wing it.
Yeah.
So they get to Diagon Alley, and Tom, the barman at the Leaky Cauldron, greets Madame Lestrange, and Hermione just says good morning, and Harry's like, too polite. You have to treat everyone like they're scum.
Oh, yeah. I forget. It's kind of like a mind meld or whatever. A mind fuck is to yeah, anyway.
Yep.
Again, you think this would have been practiced, maybe.
Yeah. And already from the beginning, even before they step through the doors, things start to go wrong because they run into someone who, like a Death Eater, who recognizes, you know, Bellatrix and is like, why the hell are you here? I thought Voldemort grounded you.
Mm-hmm.
And then again, and they have their wand, like...
Oh, again, it's Travers.
Travers, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Who they recognize as one of the Death Eaters who, you know, came to Lovegood's house when Xenophilus wanted to rat them out. So
yeah, he's appeared a few times, different scenarios, yeah.
Yes, he has. So, again, the only thing really they could have done is, like, I think maybe from the very beginning, when they got the information from Travers that Bellatrix was grounded, that it was common knowledge, that Bellatrix had lost their wand, that should have been like, okay, abort.
Yeah.
Or like, you know, yeah, or like the next plan, you know, plan.
Again, whatever. Plan G or whatever.
Mm-hmm. The backup to the backup to the backup.
Exactly. And then, so they get in there and...
Because think of the Ministry of Magic, like what they did at the beginning. I mean, it ended up not working out that well for them, but they just kind of waited. I think they watched people for a long time and picked ones that they were going to, like, pretend to be, right?
Yeah, and like...
They didn't know who they were, and that ended up being a bit of a problem. But, I mean, again, in this scenario, it could have been like, okay, I'm sure they could have snuck into Diagon Alley in some fashion. I don't know. And then, like, if the Bellatrix plan didn't work, it's like, okay, maybe we can find a different person to, like, just in the street to, like, you know, again, this would be more of a fly by the seat of your pants thing, but, like, this could be, like, a potential option.
Yeah, in the, again, I'm going back to the what if Draco Malfoy fan fiction, because I think the way it starts is somehow, you know, through, if you ever want to read it, I won't say, but somehow they get word to Bellatrix and pretend to be overheard. They get word to Bellatrix, the real Bellatrix, that this is what their plan is, and so that she will so that she will freak out and go to Gringotts herself and follow her and get her basically to do the grunt work for them.
Hmm, interesting. Okay.
Yeah, but
anyway. Yeah, I mean, I get it is the Lestrange vault. Like, they have to get to her vault. So it's why they need her specifically. But then they just end up, like, well, yeah, anyway. They end up
Yeah, so even if they could, like, BS with the wizards, with the Death Eaters, it is Griphook says to them they know, in terms of what the goblins are, you know, questioning Bellatrix. So clearly they know something is wrong, that clearly they've been informed someone might be, you know, one have an interest in the Lestrange vault. And so here comes, you know, Harry, for the first time in his life, makes the conscious decision to use an unforgivable curse, the Imperius Curse. And
whoa.
I just made note of this because, you know, Harry's never tried to use Avada Kedavra, the killing curse, but he has tried to, like, use the torture curse, Cruciatus Curse, on Bellatrix, but that was in the heat of Sirius dying and that self-righteous, yeah, you know, rage. And yeah, Harry is under pressure in this moment, but definitely is more cognizant and, okay, I'm making a decision that I'm doing something super, super unethical and illegal, you know, to get to power through this, which is, much more premeditated and decided upon than him, like, again, trying to torture Bellatrix in the Department of Mysteries.
Yeah.
So what do you think of, you know, that turn, Jess?
It's a dark turn. No, I shouldn't say a dark turn. I don't know. I don't know what to think, to be quite honest. I don't know. I'm still just trying to, like, get my head around Hermione as Bellatrix and just kind of the kind of gymnastics that have to happen. They're very different characters.
Yeah, it's very amusing to watch the behind the scenes of Helen Bohan Carter, you know, playing Emma Watson, playing Hermione Granger, playing Bellatrix Lestrange.
Playing her character.
Man, that's like a turducken of acting or something. That's wild.
Mm-hmm. And so,
yeah, again, I mean, maybe this was we could speculate if we want to be a bit more forgiving, that maybe Griphook's, you know, saying, oh, they know, like, maybe that was a specifically decided upon they know, so now Harry's going to try to do this thing. But then again, you'd think because of he would have had to practice to make sure he could actually do the Imperio curse, I would have thought, just given his past, you know, experience of not being able to do an unforgivable curse. Not that we want Harry doing unforgivable curses, but, like, mm-hmm. Yeah, it doesn't seem like a planned thing. It seems like him thinking, like, I mean, and Harry's actually very good at this. For what it's worth, I'm not happy with how the planning of this went, but I think Harry in general is good at thinking on his feet in the moment. Like, oh shit, what can I do, like, in this instant right now that would, like, salvage the situation? And this definitely does.
Yeah, and one note I had is Hermione as an actress, because we've seen in a variety of instances throughout the books that when it comes to Hermione having to act, whether she's polyjuiced or not, you know, or just trying to play dumb, like, it's really hit or miss whether she can do it convincingly.
She gets very flustered.
She gets flustered a lot of times, but she was able to do it perfectly with Umbridge and to manipulate Umbridge and get Umbridge out of their hair in book five, but could she do it in trying to get any information out of Borgin when after following Malfoy in book six? No, like Borgin saw through her immediately. And so, yeah, like it's just interesting that for what it's worth, you know, Hermione's doing Bellatrix very well. It's just, again, the premise of they already know that that Bellatrix is grounded without her wand.
Yeah, I will. I think just interesting point to what you made there. Umbridge was a teacher, so I think Hermione knows how to maybe manipulate a teacher.
Yeah,
like she starts pretend crying and all this stuff. Whereas the other, you know, what was the other one? Borgin.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think she really knows what to do.
What makes Borgin tick?
Yeah, like, you know, she doesn't know this person, whereas they know Umbridge and what she would relish in finding out. So
yeah, and what she would want to hear. But yeah, this is true. So, you know, Imperius the Goblin.
And Ron is just Ron, you know. I don't know what he's doing.
He's pretending to be a foreigner who doesn't know English.
Again,
that's probably for the best.
Yeah, like he could be doing something in this moment. I don't know what though. I just feel like he's sometimes tagging along for the sake of he's there.
Yeah.
What's he doing to help this situation?
Yep. And then so they get in the cart and again they kind of know and they get, what is it, Thieves' Downfall. They, you know, the cart passes through this waterfall and immediately the cart derails, they fall off, they fall to the ground, and you know, Hermione's no longer Bellatrix, Ron doesn't have his disguise, like basically this is something that just this magical waterfall just completely overrides any possible form of magical concealment according to Griphook.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's like, oh no, the defenses have been set off. Which, again, you know, it could be that they talked about this and it's just like the heat of the moment, like, oh no, the thing that we had discussed previously might happen, like, is happening now. But I did not read it like that. It seemed like they had not discussed this as being a potential thing that could have happened.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so they go beyond Thieves' Downfall and they get to, like, again, the Lestranges, one of the most ancient families. They have one of the biggest, deepest vaults. And it's guarded by a dragon.
Fire. That's awesome to be guarded. We got a dragon. Amy loves dragons. So
yes, I love dragons. And I have in my notes that I'm not certainly not the first to make note of this. You know, I've always complained that Harry Potter does not have enough dragons, but there is an interesting thematic appearance of dragons. How limited they are is because in book one, we get Norbert, the baby dragon.
Yes.
In book four, at the middle, we get a full grown like dragon in their prime that Harry has to fight against in the Triwizard Tournament, and here we get an elderly dragon that's near the end of his life.
Oh man!
So it's so just
we're going full circle.
So yeah, we're going full life circle of from the beginning we got a baby dragon, middle we got a, you know, grown up dragon, and then book seven at the end we get an old dragon.
Old dragon, that's interesting. I feel like you don't see a lot of old dragons in. I don't know.
I think it's so sad, though. Like, they use the clankers or whatever they call, you know, they shake the chains at it is how they scare it off because they've, like, trained it to know that it will be, like, punished or hurt when it hears that noise. So they use clankers to, like, you know, push it back away from the door. And I think it's, is it like blind? I mean, it's been living in the dark, chained up. I think it's horrible.
Yeah, it's horrible. It is at least partially blind, if not fully blind. And Jess, your thoughts, because I know how much of an animal lover and activist you are.
I mean, that's terrible. any animal. I personally don't have an issue with dragons. They're not always evil. I mean, Game of Thrones showed us that, I guess. Maybe. I don't know. It's more the driver than it is the dragon, I guess you could say. And then I guess that you could relate that to animals in general. You know, it's not, it's less often less about the animal themselves than it is the caretaker of the animal. And I guess, like, would we really expect fair treatment of an animal by the Lestranges? Like,
but they're not, they're, it's not like their personal guard dog. This is, you know, the Lestrange vault, and it's the goblins who organize, you know, the use of dragons in guarding various elements of the bank.
Okay, so now I have to be pissed at the goblins. So, I mean, I obviously, I don't like that. I'm an animal lover. I volunteer for an animal shelter. You know, you could see dogs, and I guess an argument could be made that that's how our, as a vegetarian, I guess I'll just take the stance. That's a lot, how a lot of our meat is treated before it becomes meat, you know, just kind of horrible conditions and things like that. So, not a fan. Let the dragon be free, fly around above it, or, you know, I don't know, take care of the guy, have a caretaker of the dragon, do something nice for him. He's doing a big job, so
treat
him right.
Yeah, I mean, it suggests that there's more, you know, like, it's probably not just this one. They probably have other dragons, you know, elsewhere, you know, serving as guards or whatever, which...
Yep.
And then it's disturbing. Charlie and Bill need to have a thoughtful discussion about.
I agree. Yeah. I agree.
So they get into the vault. They're looking around, and the items have been added a Jimino and Flagrante curses, which means if they touch things, it burns them, and it also, like, clones itself.
Wow.
Yeah, it's not just one, like, it, like, you pick something up and it pops out like 10 more things. It's like, it like escalates very quickly.
Yeah, it's not even like double. It's like exponential, like just things. And the whole point is that you'll be crushed under the weight of all the gold and suffocate.
Again, I know that I've talked about Hermione not always in the moment thinking on her feet. Like, I'm thinking of how when they, in book one, when they fell in the devil's snare, and they're like, we need a fire. And she's like, but there's no wood, or, you know, whatever that, it's supposed to be a funny moment, or, you know, of her not thinking of a spell that she could, that she probably does know that could work in the situation. Does Hermione not know anything to, like, deal with this? Like, I mean, they are rushed. I mean, I guess it's kind of a frantic thing. They're, like, rushing. They, like, get in the vault. The door closes behind them, you know, search fast. Like, they're kind of rushing, right?
Yeah,
so
sure, yeah.
I guess that it makes sense that they're just going to try to start picking up stuff or, like, going about this willy-nilly. But I don't know. I was also, again, surprised. Maybe not that Griphook didn't warn them about something like this, because it's very possible he was meaning not for them to be able to get out, right? But but that Hermione didn't have any ideas. I don't know. Maybe this is very advanced magic. Or
maybe this is specifically goblin magic.
Maybe. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Because, I don't know, because goblin stuff is so fancy, maybe it can't be cloned the way wizards can clone other things. Who knows?
Yeah, or maybe just things don't... Like, I think they try to... When they're looking around and, you know... Well, yeah, Griphook is like, yeah, I mean, you know, the idea is you'd be packed in here and it would, like, kill you eventually. But they try to use, when they finally spot the goblet, I think someone, Harry, tries to use Levicorpus. And it doesn't work. So maybe, yeah, things aren't just, maybe it's not normal magic in here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so they find it and it's not. Because at first they're not even quite that sure of what it is, because they're looking for a Hufflepuff or even Ravenclaw, but then they find out that Bellatrix has Hufflepuff's cup. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, Harry finally gets a hold of it, and even though it's burning him, he holds on to it, and...
Oh, yeah, actually, I have a note here. It says, someone uses Levicorpus to lift Harry up so that he can grab it.
Mm-hmm.
So did some, I didn't read the chapter right before. Maybe someone tries Aesio.
Yeah, like they try Aesio, doesn't work.
And doesn't work, okay.
And then they do Lebacorpus, and then, and as Harry finally gets the cup, Griphook gets the sword. And Griphook runs away with it, and he's screaming, "Thieves, thieves, help, thieves." So Griphook has abandoned them.
Yes.
Yeah, which sucks because, like, Harry kind of saves Griphook because he's like, because everyone's scrambling and no one was able to stand still for some reason, I guess. you know, like, the treasure's just, like, they're fumbling about, the treasure's just exploding around them and multiplying and multiplying. And Griphook is, like, submerged at one point. Mm-hmm. And Harry, like helps him,
mm-hmm.
but then like yeah, the sword flies out of his hand, and Griphook grabs it and like you know takes off.
Mm-hmm. And then again, they got it. It's like oh, no means of escape. And then finally, you know, they decide to do something really, really crazy, and they just climb on the dragon's back and just let the dragon do all the work for them of getting out of the caves.
Naturally.
Well, yeah, the vault opens, so the doors close, you know, they're like scrambling in all this treasure, but yeah, because there's voices outside. I forget who it is. I don't know if it's other wizards or other goblins have finally
caught up with them.
I think, yeah, a mixture of both Death Eaters and goblins, so they like the treasure like goes spilling out, you know, and they kind of go sliding out.
Yeah,
and then they like abscond with the dragon.
Yeah, they abscond with the dragon. The dragon's basically just, you know, digging out of the caverns and goes up to the top floor and, you know, bust out of the roof. And what is it? What is last? Turning its horned head towards the cool outside air it could smell beyond the entrance, it took off, with Harry, Ron, and Hermione still clinging to its back. It forced its way through the metal doors, leaving them buckled and hanging from the hinges as it staggered into Diagon Alley and launched itself into the sky.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Like a boss.
like a boss.
I really want to go on that ride. We were going to go to Florida you know, earlier this year, and then it didn't happen because of, you know, pregnancy and stuff. But like I was kind of excited to go. I wanted to go to Harry Potter World.
Yeah.
And yeah, I've heard that's a pretty good ride. The escape.
I bet it'll be fun.
Yeah.
The escape from Gringotts.
Yeah, yeah. I've heard that people like it.
Mm. Alrighty, so those are our two chapters. So we can move on now to Gothic Geek Out. So Holly, I don't remember, like, did you do a Gothic Geek Out? Did I remind you about our little exercises or?
I remember that you guys do them. I mean, I think there's a lot of Gothic elements, you know, in the Gringotts chapter, just in general.
Yeah, so I guess I'll start with mine. My Gothic Geek Out is just the caravans of the vaults, because a lot of Gothic literature, a good chunk of thematic themes, I'm so intelligent, a lot of themes are, and a lot of motifs and plot points in Gothic literature hinge on, you know, people inheriting certain things.
Yeah.
A lot of times it's inheriting the haunted house, but it also could be inheriting cursed objects. So literally, you know, going to this place where, you know, where the one of the oldest families in wizarding Britain, you know, hoards all its fancy stuff. And it's just it's interesting, all the pure blood families, because we have the Malfoys, because Malfoy is a, if you look at it in French, it comes from malfoi, which means bad faith. And then we have Lestrange, you know, which it, right. They say Lestrange in the movies. I refuse that. I always say Lestrange. So we have another wizarding family that's pure blood that probably immigrated super early, you know, from probably during the Norman invasion, you know. So all, yeah. these, all these ancient families are like super old and probably originally continental.
Yeah.
Continental. So yeah, we just got old families with all their fancy schmancy objects, and I think that's very gothic.
It is very gothic.
Yeah. Very gothic. Did you have one, Jess, or?
I do. I'm going to go for it. I'm going to say the wand that killed Sirius and Neville's parents. I think just like an object that has kind of a history. And I guess this is kind of my horror roots kind of coming through, because I am always fascinated with the Warrens, Lorraine and Ed Warren. You know, they have that, like, the cursed objects museum, like a doll and stuff like that. So I know this isn't necessarily cursed, but its history is very dark. And that to me, again, gothic horror, kind of like this cursed thing that isn't necessarily, I mean, a wand, I guess, essentially in this series is a weapon of sorts, but, you know, I guess it's not like I would think like the sword itself could be, have like a, I don't know. The wand is a weapon. Mm-hmm. But, you know, like the gun that killed so-and-so, or, you know, that's always kind of has some, a little bit of stigma. And I think that's the great basis for a lot of gothic novels is the cursed object, like the Maltese Falcon. You know, that's kind of where I always like to go with that stuff. So
yes, no, that's good. Just thinking of gothic stuff, I did not go to it, but apparently in San Francisco, there, where is it, Holly? Like that wax doll museum?
Ooh.
Yeah. I've never been there.
I don't know. I'll just remember someone, like, I think Michelle, like, kept saying, like, anyone wants to go to that? Like, feel free, because I ain't not going. And I'm like, oh, yeah. Jess, if Jess were here, we would go.
I mean, I would go. It sounds creepy, but I like creepy. So it'd be fun.
Okay. So did you have any more to add, Holly, or?
No, not really. I mean, again, I didn't pick anything specific because I didn't think on it too hard, but yeah, I mean, just in general, you know, we've got cursed objects, you know, ancient things handed down through ancient families, you know, deep treasure vaults, like in this, like, you know, ancient, well, I don't know how ancient the building is, I guess, but like,
yeah,
you know, protected treasure vaults, you know, beasts in chains, you know, all that good stuff.
Yeah. Alrighty then, and then we move on to our tarot of the day, which I'm proud of myself because I picked at random the Ace of Cups, which is just funny because the whole pursuit of a very fancy schmancy cup, you know, Hufflepuff's cup.
Oh yeah.
That's really funny.
Yeah, so Ace of Cups is with the Ace of Cups, divine love and compassion are pouring through you. You are a vessel for deep spiritual love from the universe, and you can't help but let the love flow through you and into the world. You receive love, you give love, you are love. Now is the perfect time for you to open your heart and experience the rich flow of emotions available to you right now. You are more receptive to creative opportunities, loving connections, and deep compassion for other living beings. Again, like, despite the obvious symbolism of the goblet.
Yeah.
You know, ace, and again, an ace card is always symbolism for, like, new beginning. So it's all about, like, and again, the cups are the element of water, the water suit within the minor arcana of the tarot. So it's all about, like, love, connection, relationships. If anything, I feel like everything is, like, the opposite of all this bad blood between the goblins and the humans, both at a societal, cultural level, and that affects the very specific interpersonal relationship between this one goblin, Griphook, and the golden trio. So there isn't love flowing through anything. The only thing that's flowing is all these burning goblets and gold that's going to crush them to death.
Yeah.
It's like the opposite, like if the card were played upside down.
Yeah. I'm curious, the reverse Ace of Cups is a sign that you are in connection with your subconscious mind and in tune to your intuition. You are exploring this part of yourself privately right now and discovering how you can bring more intuition and flow into your life. On the flip side, the Ace of Cups reverse may be a sign that you are repressing your emotions, not wanting to express yourself fully to the outside world. I think both Griphook and the Golden Trio are guilty of this because neither of them are revealing their true intention, because none of them, neither side is happy with this bargain, but they're just going along with it so they can get what they want in the very short term.
Yeah,
that's true. I mean, they are trying to keep their mission as secret as possible. And, you know, Jess mentioned, like, you know, do we know, like, we have to be wary of allegiances. They don't know much about Grip Hook. So maybe it's not trying to be shady, but just really not wanting to spread too much of what they're doing.
Any other thoughts, Jess?
Not really. This is an interesting card for the, I mean, I don't know. I would love it to be like a love, new love beginning chapter, because I'm a romantic and you know that. But it's not really applicable here.
Yeah, when you said Ace of Cups, I was like, oh my gosh, that's so perfect. And then you read what it means. It's like, oh no. No, none of that happening. The opposite of love and compassion is happening.
Yep. And with that, we can move on to the Black Moon Astrology cards. And the one I picked out was a zodiac sign, card number 16, which is, you'll love this, Jess, Cancer.
Yay, Cancer. I'm so Cancer.
Yes, you are so Cancer. And Cancer also, again, a zodiac sign affiliated with water, just as the cups are affiliated with water. Which House of Slytherin altogether is affiliated with water.
Cancers can be pretty evil, so.
They can. Because if a Cancer is bad, they're evil.
Yeah, we are.
Yeah. So, Cancers are reclusive and they tend to hide their feelings and have alternating moods. They're emotionally vulnerable and are easily wounded. They can be downright touchy, and when feelings are bruised, Cancers can come across as crabby and harsh. Kind of sounds like Grip Hook a little bit.
Minus
the emotionally vulnerable part, because he doesn't show us that side.
Yeah.
Cancer is a sign of the mother, and those ruled by Cancer tend to be overprotective of their offspring, which means they all like to control and take over. After all, the child is an extension of the mother, who also needs to be protected, so she must remain strong and take care of her young. Cancer is the sign of the imagination. They have a rich fantasy life, so they will do well in areas of creative writing, arts, also music. And with their gut reactions, Cancers are also can be very accurate psychics. Not necessarily like psychic ability, but as what you were talking about, Holly, the fact that Harry, much more so than Hermione, can think on his feet in terms of, you know, salvaging very high stress situations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Let's see. Right now, your moods may be changeable, just like the moon's phases throughout the month, and you may want to hide and withdraw from hurt and pain. Perhaps this pain is real or imagined, but in this solitude, you will build a greater strength to face whatever it is that you hold back. When the Cancer card presents itself in a reading, you can be assured emotions are high. You may want to withdraw, or you may be dealing with someone who is withdrawing or depressed at this time. There is a feeling of being connected to the unseen world, and this includes the world of ghosts and spirits. This card can indicate inherited psychic abilities and even witch blood. This is a typhoon of power behind Cancer's strong feelings. Well, certainly feelings are running high, just not all the fuzzy.
Feelings are running high.
Not all the fuzzy ones, all the adrenaline betrayal ones.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think often the Cancer sign is associated with like warm, fuzzy softness. And that's not necessarily true. You know, I mean, I think emotions in general are better applicable, and feeling those intensely is something that we are dealing with in these chapters. The only thing that you kind of, when you talked about the mothering aspect, when I think it was Grip Hook could not, like, kept like following the Golden Trio around, kind of like listening. That was very my motherly. So I don't know what that says about me, but.
And even Ron said, like, he can give my mother lessons, because that's what Molly was doing before they left.
Exactly. So we got some mom, hover mom vibes there.
Yep. Any thoughts, Holly?
No, I mean, you know, I think that all kind of covers it, makes sense. I mean, I don't know a lot of Cancers personally, so I don't know a lot about the sign itself.
Amin is a Cancer.
He is? What are the months for Cancer?
Cancer is late June, early July.
Late June, early July. Oh, okay. Yeah, so like...
Why is Dad calling me?
I don't know. David called me a second ago because he's traveling. Mm-hmm. Yeah, anyway, yeah, like my brother-in-law's on the cusp, I think, of like Gemini Cancer. So we're not sure which way he swings, I guess.
Yeah, I was gonna call Dad last night, but I just got so tired. But anyway, yeah, I'll call him afterwards. So,
but yeah, if the negative side of Cancer is like, you know, betrayal,
worse than Scorpio.
Yeah, like betrayal, fear, like emotions running high,
vindictiveness
with regard to like being possessive, you know, I mean, that definitely fits kind of Grip Hook's, like, you know, outlook on, you know, he wants the sword back, he doesn't trust Harry to you know, and I guess rightfully so, to make good on the deal. Yep.
Alrighty, and then we move on to our last exercise, fan fiction time. So, Holly, I think ours kind of aligned, but because you started to dip into it a little bit earlier in the episode. But yes, do share your fan fiction what if.
Yeah, I mean, my what if is just a glaringly big, like, what if they just explained more to Grip Hook and, you know, and I guess I think there could have been a way to do it without revealing everything they were doing. But, you know, just look, we need this for something. We don't actually want it because we want treasure or a shiny object or whatever. Like, we have no material interest in it, to be honest. But it has this extra property that is very useful to us. So, you know, we want to give it back to you, but we need to use it. So either we can give it back to you at a later time, or, I mean, we'll give it back to you, but you have to, like, promise to let us use it. I mean, I guess that would be a big risk, maybe, on their part.
I guess the one of two several things. The possible downsides is, even if Grip Hook agrees and does it doing it, just the fact that the information, I think Harry's operating from, I don't know, justly or unjustly, because again, he doesn't know Grip Hook's allegiances, just that he has distaste for wizards, you know, wizards mm-hmm. in general. Just that I think his fear is, even if they're not telling Grip Hook what they're doing, and Grip Hook, you know, agrees to it, the fact if it got out that they had made this bargain and people putting it together, like, why would they need this sword of Gryffindor? Which, it's one thing if they were, like, negotiating, like, an actual Horcrux. Like, if they had the locket and Grip Hook wanted it back and that whole thing, and people knew that he had the locket. It's like, oh, it's a Horcrux, you know, if other people could piece it together. But I don't think it's common knowledge that the whole reason they want the sword is because it's filled with basilisk blood or venom mm-hmm. because of Harry using it in book two. So I don't... You know, I don't think people would immediately think, oh, they're, like, hunting Horcruxes, you know, because they want this sword. Like, its actual property is very, very limited. Or, well...
I mean, once they take the goblet successfully, Voldemort knows that Harry knows. Like, yeah. Voldemort knows what they're up to as soon as that act happens.
Yeah.
So, I would posit that if they could do that stealthily, you know, without causing a huge ruckus at Gringotts, you know, Voldemort might even not realize what had happened for a little while. Like, he wouldn't realize there'd been a theft, at least for a little while, potentially.
And then if they'd been more honest, I think there may be, because Grip Hook is showing this position, this very anti-wizard position, and again, like, I think maybe they're coming from the position that even if they were trying to explain to them their reasoning in very vague terms, because Grip Hook is so distrustful that he just, unless they gave him, like, very detailed, like, he just won't believe that it isn't about monetary, you know, gain, unless they divulge specifics, possibly. Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just of the mind that I think it could have been handled a little bit better than the way that they handled it, which was, well, we'll say we'll give it back, but we just won't say when. You know, it's clearly not forthcoming. You know, they're clearly hiding something and he can tell. I just think it could have been handled a little bit better, I think.
Yeah. I'm thinking that is the one that I wrote down, but I'm just thinking another one of what we touched in that scenario of what if they were successful to the point that they were able to surreptitiously, you know, by really planning thoroughly with Grip Hook and being able to evade things and be able to sneakily get in and out of Gringotts without making a fuss and without the dramatic dragon escape? Like if they had been able to sneakily, you know, go about their business, you know, what would that have looked like, and how long would it have taken for, like, how long was it going to be before either real Bellatrix or Voldemort went to Gringotts and finally figured out, like, how much time could they have bought by sneakily getting the cup?
Yeah, I think this is actually a bigger question, because considering that Gringotts had been warned about the wand and knew something was up, and obviously the real Bellatrix at the manor had been like, when she sees the sword and she starts flipping out, like, oh my gosh, we have a problem. Why weren't they, how are they not beat to the vault? Because they planned for weeks and weeks, right? Supposedly. How come in all that time, Bellatrix or Death Eaters or someone, Voldy himself, whoever, how come in all that time they did not go to the, like, the Death Eaters did not go to the vault to check on anything? Maybe they did and everything was fine, so they assumed it was no problem, and then, you know, and then weeks later the break-in happened, so maybe that makes sense.
So either everything was fine, or Bellatrix, again, because Bellatrix refused to summon Voldemort when she sees the sword, because true. So mm-hmm. it could be Bellatrix, you know, withholding information out of self-preservation.
That's true. Maybe she didn't say anything.
Like, maybe she didn't, like, well, again, because it's the Malfoys would know, and, you know, the Malfoys would know about the sword, but again, they're kind of, you know, iffy right now whether they would, like, and, you know, Bellatrix is, yeah, anyway. Yeah,
if things had gone more smoothly, though, like, back to your original thought, my thinking is that they would have been in the vault, they would have had the cup and the sword. I think Harry would have taken care of it then and there. Like, why wait? Like, no wasting mm-hmm. time. I think he would have, like, used mm-hmm. the sword to smash it right away. And then they could have either, you know, they could have left it there or taken it with them. I think either way, Voldemort would have figured out what they were up to. Because either the cup's there, destroyed, or it's gone, you know, so either way.
Yeah, the only thing more would be, well, yeah, I'm sure he would have touched it, looked at it closely, but because with the Ministry of Magic, Hermione makes a copy of the locket to keep with Umbridge so that Umbridge doesn't put the alarm that her locket is missing. So maybe, mm-hmm. you know, but who, again, if Voldy himself inspects it, how long could, like, such a fake, you know, continue to just sit there undetected and under no suspicion?
But it going smoothly, I think we'd assume they get out smoothly as well, which means they'd probably still have the sword.
Yeah, well, I guess.
Yeah.
Well, I guess if they get out smoothly, there's the question of Grip Hook. Okay, give me my sword.
Well, yeah, then they have that situation, which maybe ends up causing a problem anyway.
Jess, did you have a fanfic what if?
I did, and I feel like it might be a little bit of a cop-out, but that's okay. It's what if the dragon wasn't there at the, like, what would they, how would they get out?
Good question. Honestly, I do not believe, like, there's got to be more entrances into the vault system in those caverns than just, like, the front doors of Gringotts. There are other tunnels in there that I'm sure the goblins know about. That's my headcanon.
Yeah.
You can't I'm assuming apparition is not an option.
No.
Because obviously that would have been choice numero uno.
Yeah. But yeah, I would definitely think there are more tunnels. I guess it's a question of how much could they get an Imperious Goblin to help them get out.
Well, this relates again to my whole beef about this is how, like, what was the original plan to get out? Because I feel like it was not, we're going to hijack this dragon, like, you know, again, flying by the seat of our pants here because we're being, we've been discovered and we're being chased. And, you know, so like, how would they have gotten out slash what was the plan for them to get out? I guess, assuming it all went silent, you know, smoothly.
I get like there'd
be no alarms. They'd take the cart back up. So I guess the way to do it forcefully is just try to commandeer the cart and try to go back the way they came, but they might have, you know, some trouble, but yeah, I don't know. Or find a different way. Yeah.
I don't know, because you can't, again, like, you know, Harry's like throwing the Imperius curse left and right, but we already know it's canon that, like, you know, one wizard cannot put one enchantment on a dragon. It's just too big and it's too powerfully magical. You need like a dozen wizards shouting the same spell to like overpower a dragon. So it's not like Harry could just Imperio the dragon and be like, eat them all, destroy, burn them all, and do like a Danny Daenerys Targaryen.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm trying to remember what I even know about Gringotts, because like, I feel maybe there were some descriptions in the first book of things they saw, like on the way down. So there's definitely probably an assortment of creatures, things that could somehow be utilized to help them get out.
Yeah, or they could have done a like Jurassic World, Jurassic Park, where they get another dragon to lure to the other dragon and have them fight each other.
Okay, yeah, I mean, I know there's like trolls, like cave trolls down there. I mean, again, this is what the trio does. They kind of improvise things haphazardly. So it might have taken a lot longer rather than just, here's a dragon, let's commandeer it to blast out of here. It might have been a bit more of an elaborate chase and mm-hmm. getting lost. And I mean, who knows what, but.
Or what if, yeah. Yeah, I'm just thinking, what if they, like, again, go through all the tunnels and then they lose them, but they're lost. And so it's like, you know, waiting them out.
Yeah, yeah. But again, I would have liked to have known what the original plan was.
There was no plan because they're 17.
Oh, to be 17.
Yeah. Alrighty. And thus concludes this episode of Rambling Raven Puffs. Next time, we will go into chapters 27 and 28, The Final Hiding Place and The Missing Mirror. So again, thank you so much for joining us, Holly.
Yeah, thank you, Holly.
Yeah, it's definitely been fun. I've enjoyed doing this. I missed a couple books, but yeah, it's been great.
Yeah. Good. So catch all you guys later. Bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to the Rambling Raven Puffs. Our theme music was composed by John Williams, recreated by Kinez Norwar. This podcast is but one of the many shows produced by Sophie Mare Studios. You can get the latest news by following our social media, Sophie Mare Studios on Instagram, Sophie Mare Studios on TikTok, and SophieMare_pods on Twitter. You can connect with other listeners through the Sophie Mare Studios Discord server. You can support the show by becoming a patron at patreon.com/SophieMareStudios, all lowercase. Higher tiers get access to even cooler perks.
That was the Sophie Mare Studios podcast.